big thank you to all of our panelists. You have certainly given us a lot of food for thought. At this point, we want to open it up to your questions, both here in the room and online. Zachary's going to be going around handing out the microphone to take questions. I think perhaps first maybe we'll take a question from our online group. Oh, and actually, wait, sorry. Before we start, when you're asking a question, please give us your name and the institution you're representing, if there is one. That goes for the online folks as well, if we can get that information. And given that we have such a large panel, I wanted to remind our panelists, if you can, to please keep your answers brief and that you certainly do not all need to answer every question. Thank you.
That's good.
From the USAID EATS project, I'm taking a question from our online audience from John Bergenti. He says, how do we convince governments to keep markets liberalized when they haven't seen increased use through the private sector? Uganda may be a rather unique case in its relative commitment to liberalization, but 10 years later, the government is not seeing results. Subsidies start to look tempting from their perspective.
I'll perhaps start the ball rolling on that. And I think the question speaks directly to some of the issues that we raised today, that it's not necessarily, market development is not necessarily something that just happens by itself. Well, it will not happen by itself if there is not a facilitating environment. I can't speak necessarily to the particulars in Uganda, but I do know from my experiences and what I have seen is that if you don't have all of the various elements in place that we talked about, if you don't have the infrastructure capability, if you've not made the investments in research and development and extension and distribution, dissemination of knowledge, it's very difficult. If you don't have the financial programs in place, whether it's credit guarantees or educational programs, just so that private financial institutions understand how the agricultural sector works. It's this entire package, and I can understand that there is a temptation to want to reach back and say, well, it's not happening, the government has to intervene again or something, but again, this more holistic approach and look at the marketplace is just that much more critical, and I think that's highlighted by the question.
I think to add to that, I think the government can't just withdraw from the fertilizer sector and sit back. It has to have a vision for what it wants to achieve in the agricultural sector in terms of production targets, what crops it wants to increase, and communicate that information to the private sector, and then provide incentives for them to get involved in terms of, it could be any tax incentives, it can also be investing in the infrastructure that we talked about, to make the private sector want to get involved in providing the fertilizer that is required in different parts of the country. I think the basic thing is the government cannot just withdraw from the fertilizer sector and leave it at that. It has to also make sure that the private sector has the incentives that it needs and is aware of what the government's plans are for the agricultural sector, communicate that to the private sector, and discuss ways in which they can collaborate to reach their common goals.
Can I just add to this? A very practical thing that donors can do in the situation you raise is show other country experiences. When Larry Paulson is here in the audience and IFTC were in Bangladesh in the 90s, a lot of the major success of that fertilizer privatization and liberalization were bringing key Bangladeshi officials to other places to see how a private market could work. Right next door to Uganda in Kenya, you have a situation where the government has taken many of these measures talked about in the policy brief. The access to agro dealer, the mileage between the average farmer and the average agro dealer is more or less been cut in half. I don't know what the specific statistics are. Maria and Jason do. And fertilizer availability has increased significantly. So there are countries nearby to wherever you are where you can see the approaches outlined here really working and expanding fertilizer availability, and donors can help show that to policymakers.
I would only add very quickly that my experience in Nepal, if you're the government there is struggling. They've been in and out of subsidies over the years. But that seemed to be one of the major players by which they tried to move fertilizer into the country and accommodate everybody. But the lack of its success, I think, indicates there's a lot of other challenges that they are not addressing. And I think in there lies some of the issues that maybe in Uganda that there's factors. I went to, in our survey, for example, I identified something that most people would not understand or wouldn't believe, that in a very poor country like Nepal, the cost of fertilizers amongst farmers was not an issue. They didn't care. The problem was they couldn't get it. And so within reason, I mean, obviously it got too high, they wouldn't buy, but that was not the reason they weren't buying. The problem was, so subsidy, the cost of the fertilizers was not the issue. The supply of the product really was an issue. So some of those other issues might also, you know, they may not be addressing the real problems because subsidy is not addressing them.
Hi, I'm Larry Paulson, USAID agriculture officer, retired. Thanks for the introduction, David. I'm going to take advantage of my retired status to take a longer view and make a comment that I hope maybe will inspire some responses. The success of IFDC is, well, I would say it another way. If you look at the, if I hear the reports of this project, the presentations of policy issues, the AFAP recommendations, that's pretty much all a summation of what was, is it on?
Yeah. I'll take it towards your mouth.
Closer, okay. The findings of the IFDC's Bangladesh Fertilizer Improvement Project, which ended about 20 years ago, has pretty much reflected all of it. So this isn't new. The story is well known. One comment is USAID is full of clever people and hires clever people as contractors and grantees, and so we all have known for a long time what's to be done. We want to jump to there. Where USAID shoots itself in the foot, and by extension sets up its contractors and grantees to fail is with its short attention span. The Fertilizer Improvement Distribution Improvement Program in Bangladesh, which is only turning the distribution program, converting it from a government monopoly to a private sector enterprise, took 15 years and more of succeeding projects just to get to that point. It couldn't have been done in 3 or 5 years. It was unrealistic. Even in 15 years, it required the sudden appearance of cheap Korean motors that drove shallow irrigation development in the 80s, coupled with some government crises, budget crises that made them rethink their subsidy program. USAID and food security, I think, needs to take at least a 20-year commitment. It'd be nice if its implementing mechanisms are similarly long, so that things didn't have to get done in a very short time. I think we won't succeed without that long-term attention to a program and a long-term commitment.
I'll jump in again. Thank you for your comment, because I think it is extremely important. And I'd like to follow with another example that IFDC and other cooperating institutions have enjoyed some success with, and that is the country of Albania, where, again, a very long-term commitment to start from the grassroots and to build an industry association and to use that instrument to work together with private businesses, with the government, and to nurture and grow an agricultural fertilizer marketplace. And as you said, the luxury there was that for whatever reason, they benefited from a longer-term view, a longer-term commitment, and over a 10-year span has developed a well-functioning, well-established, sustainable fertilizer marketplace. And the key, I think, is the level of funding that went into it and the longer-term commitment
from the beginning that we were going to build this marketplace as effectively as possible and sticking to it. So the kinds of approaches that we're talking about here. It's not a one-time fix. It's not set up the regulations and build the roads and everything will take care of itself. It's an ongoing effort to recognize what the needs are in the marketplace, what the shortcomings are in terms of infrastructure or information needs, and trying as best you can to address them. Those are the supporting services that help the private sector market linkages across the value chain work more smoothly. So it's always an ongoing effort and endeavor, and not set it and forget it. So,
just a short contribution there. I agree. I couldn't agree more that we need to take a more long-term view if we want to be successful in terms of building up the fertilizer sector. A key obstacle we face in Africa, which we haven't found a way of getting around, is that subsidies are often used as a political tool. They're not in the development space. If they were in the development space, you could see this long-term view being taken. But that's something that we really need to address, because otherwise you see fertilizers on the radar just when elections are around the corner, then the interest dies down. And then when the election's around the corner, then the interest dies down. So that's a real obstacle that we policymakers need to find a way to address.
With that, we'll take a question from online.
This one's from Dawit Solomon. Unfortunately, I don't have their organization. Dawit says, recent fieldwork in Ethiopia show that farmers appreciate fertilizer but can only afford to apply one-third of the recommended rate. What mechanisms are available, such as public-private partnership, to make up the remaining difference? Dawit gives the example of potentially using alternative biofertilizers from rural communities.
I'm not particularly familiar with that particular situation, but again, going back to my experience, one of the issues that came up in Nepal in our project was there's a lot of interest, I guess, and well-intended interest, but from where I stand as an agronomist, maybe a little bit misguided as far as the intent or the end game of it, and that is the role of organic matter versus commercial fertilizers. I have always been a strong proponent of utilizing manures and green manures and things of that sort that are available on the farm or nearby that can be incorporated into the system. To me, whether I'm talking to farmers in developed countries or underdeveloped countries, to me that's like step one. That's a given to me. I don't even hardly address that. I mean, that's obvious to me that that's what ought to be done. However, you have to realize that does a couple of things. It does provide some nutrients, but it also provides a better tilth of the soil and a better environment for the seed and so forth. So that's a good practice, a general practice. The problem is with that, and where the people, I think, get a little misguided, is they feel like that can substitute, manure can just substitute for, especially in a high-yielding system or where you're trying to achieve higher yields to be more profitable. The demand, the difference between what manure can supply and what the crop needs is it can't do that in most cases. And so in most cases, I say, yes, start with it. And that's where soil testing and a knowledge of what you're doing is kind of important, because then you can put together a nutrient plan that makes sense, and you can utilize the proper fertilizers at the proper rates to complement the manure that you're using. And that way, I think that ties the system together. And, that would be my comment on that.
My name is Samba Kawa, and I'm from the Bureau for Food Security here in Washington. My question was actually about, it's very close to the one we just had, and the last speaker spoke many times on them. I've been thinking about what is the future. This question is for IFDC and IFAP. What's the future for organic manures, for organic fertilizers, or inorganic-organic mixtures, if this is something you are thinking of? Because like the last speaker said, organic matter is extremely important. We can see that, say, from the pH. If you have high organic matter in your soil, I think you may need less of other fertilizers if your pH is in agreement. Also, the type of soil. You mentioned the four R's. If I can remember them, you talked about the right fertilizer. So you have to know where do you apply what type of fertilizer. And we talked about the right rate. If the soil is high in organic matter, are you going to need a higher rate or a lower rate? Also, the time. When do you apply this fertilizer? Is it like when it is raining or what time? And you talk about the place. The sandy soil, I think we need more organic matter if you have this. So I think we have to give considerations to this. So my question is, do you in your arsenals have any plan for organic fertilizers mixed with inorganic fertilizers? Looking also at the additional benefits of organic fertilizers as it may relate to keeping the environment clean, because a farmer can actually make use of the animal dung, the crop residues to make compost and other things. What's your opinion on this?
Thank you, Salva. I think that's a very good point, and we've talked about a lot today in terms of the market distribution and procurement on commercial inorganic fertilizers, but balanced fertilization, soil health and fertility is, I think, the key objective in terms of the work that IFDC tries to accomplish. And by that I mean a full recognition of the value and the contribution, as Ray said, of a combination of organic and inorganic soil amendments and nutrients to provide the best possible growing medium for the crop in the agroclimatic zone that we're talking about. And those vary everywhere across a country, across a continent, and across the world. So there's no cut and dried, this is what we need to do here. It's a very site-specific kind of an approach, which therefore makes it more expensive, more data-intensive, but nonetheless required and recognized. Now, there are some leading indicators, if you will, like soil pH, that indicate that you need to pay a little bit more attention to this kind of fertility balance approach. But certainly, I think the IFDC's approach is to recognize the need and the importance and the contribution of a balanced nutrition and soil fertility effort.
David Jesse, European Eurasia Bureau, here in USAID. Are there serious environmental issues that we need to be thinking about at this stage of the development of this sector?
I think for me, if you're talking about fertilizer use in Africa and environmental issues, I think the main environmental threat is not using enough fertilizers, because we are continuously mining our soils through crop harvesting, and we don't replenish sufficient nutrients through the use of chemical fertilizers. So I think the main threat that we face at this moment is we don't use enough fertilizers. Certainly we promote the environmentally sustainable and responsible use of fertilizers, but in terms of amounts, I think we are definitely saying we need to use more fertilizers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think some of the negative effects, again, that we've talked about, we see time and again in countries where fertilization programs that are not taking into consideration the kind of balanced approach that Ray has talked about do contribute to soil degradation, do affect the responsiveness of fertilizer, of yields to fertilizer. And you have those kinds of negative effects that need to be overcome. But as Maria said, there are, of course, instances, I suspect, where there is misapplication or overapplication of fertilizers. But on average across sub-Saharan Africa, the issue is very much one of continual nutrient mining and a need for additional fertilizer, again, in a balanced and appropriate kind of a framework.
My only comment there would be that I think, they've got to go hand in hand. Coming from the fertilizer industry, I always tried to run a parallel path in education about the importance of soil management, environmental stewardship. I think a lot of times fertilizer, or whether it's organic or commercial fertilizer, gets a bad rap because of other things that it goes on. You know, it's not properly managed. It's allowed to leach. It's oversupplied. It's allowed soil erosion is a factor. All those things. I mean, there are secondary effects. But if you put it the right amount in the right place at the right time, you know, you minimize that. Plus, to me, you know, from an agronomist, going back to my original premise that you're trying to grow higher yields, be more profitable, that type of thing, the best way to control nutrients is put it in the crop. You know, if you're not getting it up in the crop and you're applying it to the soil and you're wasting it, not only money-wise, but you're potentially impacting the environment. Mm-hmm. So I think education to get people to understand the proper applications, getting it up into the crop, is probably one of the best environmental protection programs that we can have.
Just along those lines, just to one ad edum there, is one of the major projects that IFTC has been involved in a long time, and particularly starting in Bangladesh, but now moving into various areas in Africa, is fertilizer deep placement, or specifically urea deep placement. Again, to place the fertilizer in the appropriate zone within the root system, which reduces the volatilization and cuts back on the leaching of nutrients because of the readily available placement of the nutrient, and again, getting it into the plant and into the grain. So, you know, certainly those kinds of efforts are underway and have been for some time, and we're trying to spread those. But the key is you wind up with a technology like urea deep placement, which significantly reduces the nitrogen losses, has an environmental benefit. It has a benefit to the farmers in that more of the nitrogen that they purchase is directed to the plant, and therefore we're seeing increasing yields with less fertilizer use and less loss, either atmospheric or leaching through the soil. So kind of a win-win-win kind of a situation that are quite important.
We have a question from online.
Building off of what Ray was just saying on the best way to get to manage crop nutrients is to get it into the crop itself. Thomas Reinsch from the USDA asks, how is the nutritional value of the crop evaluated?
Well, I think there's there's mechanisms in place, which often is unfortunately not available to a lot of developing countries. But plant analysis, seed analysis, there's different ways of measuring, you know, what the value of that particular crop might be. Quality issues. As you go into specialty crops, they tend to identify, you know, whether you're going, you know, bananas or whether you're going, some other kind of crop, that really quality is important. The industry defines what those parameters are and how you manage them. I tend to look often at plant health more from a nutritional standpoint of growing the crop. I love to see, to me, it's a final extension of soil testing and developing a higher production system, is to complement that with plant analysis. So you measure not only what's going into the soil and the rate, the placement, all that, but you're actually measuring what's actually getting up into the crop. And that together, you know, is a tremendous management tool. And so there are ways, laboratory analysis is the way to identify the qualities of what you produce.
Really got to get close to it. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is John Holtzman. I'm in the World Bank and Agriculture and Environmental Services. It's not a...
Now I think it's working. My name is John Holtzman. I was a USAID contractor for many years. I'm now in the World Bank and in Agriculture and Environmental Services, working on agribusiness indicators in Africa, courtesy of the Gates Foundation, which is work that's been underway for a couple of years, and we've done studies in African countries, and one of our core indicator groups is fertilizer. And one of the things that, is it Ray or Roy?
Ray.
Ray said that really echoed with me is fertilizer use profitable in these countries? And you laid out a number of agronomic and soil chemistry kinds of issues, which I think were very pertinent. You know, we're saying we're taking a systemic view by doing a value chain analysis, but it's vertical and it's narrow. And Maria said at the beginning of her talk that 30% of the attribution for yield increases is from fertilizer. What's the other 70%? So, you know, we're also looking at seed. We're also looking at mechanization. And then the next phase, it looks as if we'll be in business for another 3 years, we'll be looking at irrigation as well as access to land. So, you know, I think it's nice that you've got indicators of fertilizer profitability. And there are ratios to do this. There are nutrient output ratios. There are value cost ratios. And depressingly, it's very hard to get this information in most countries. It's not that hard to get fertilizer import information disaggregated by type and even price information, which IFDC is generating. But is fertilizer use profitable? And we would ask that question of researchers, and they couldn't answer it. And it just blew me away. So, you know, why are we pushing this commodity when you can't really tell us what the bang for the buck is? And in some countries, partly because maize prices are low, the ratios are terrible. Fertilizer use is not profitable. Surprise, surprise, farmers don't use it. So anyway, this is more of a comment than a question. But I think it's important to look at the factors that affect cost and to try to reduce cost and improve the regulatory and policy environment. But ultimately, in African countries, most of these places are not going to import huge volumes of fertilizer. They're not going to apply fertilizer at the same costs we do in the United States. So you've got to look carefully, crop by crop, as to whether or not it's profitable. And it's no surprise that, you know, Ray found that in Nepal it's going on vegetables, fruits and vegetables in peri-urban production zones. So anyway, this is a plea for not just looking at the regulatory framework and the factors that affect cost, but to look carefully crop type by crop type at how profitable is fertilizer use.
Yeah, in Africa it's a bit tricky because farmers, they do of course ask themselves the question of whether it's profitable, but then they will also use fertilizer because they know that if they don't, they won't get anything. They won't get a yield. So profitability in the monetary sense is not the only issue that they're looking at. They're looking at, can I produce something to feed my family? Yeah. So
I would kind of add one comment to yours, John, and then also respond. There's certain situations where farmers don't see their basic food grain crop as sort of a profit-making enterprise. It's a sort of risk management enterprise. If they get a little more money or they want to put something into a profit-making enterprise, they're going to do something else. But those situations aside, I think part of the reason for this approach and emphasis on the regulatory and policy environment to bring costs down is profitability is going to be partly a function of cost. So for some set of those farmers that you're talking about where it may not be profitable right now at this year's maize prices to put fertilizer on, it would have been profitable, or it will be profitable 5 years from now if costs come down 20% for fertilizer. A final response I'd make is, and the EAT brief makes this briefly, but this is a brief about fertilizer, not about, you know, food and agricultural output markets. But there's a lot happening and that we know needs to happen in food and agricultural output markets in terms of greater volumes and risk management and alternative uses for maize in terms of growing poultry demand and stuff like that. So just as we sort of have this hope and vision that input markets will evolve and become better and broader, you know, there's the same vision simultaneously for output markets, which will change the profitability and risk, at least making a certain growing number of farmers, we hope, see fertilizers more profitable.
I think that was an excellent question. Though my comment, John, is one of the reasons that we don't often have the answers we'd like in this regard is it's a very complex question that we have. We don't have a lot of data, hard data. We have a lot of qualitative data as far as how I think a lot of times, you know, the problem we have in developing countries is because a lot of these other factors that impact yield have a negative impact. And so we're not truly measuring the value of fertilizer. And some of the examples I gave earlier, in fact, you're not getting any benefit from your fertilizer. Why? Because all these other things are going on. And so I think you have to measure that. One of the follow-up questions very quickly that I had after I left Nepal, and they were wanting to, you know, I didn't put it in my report for a good reason, but they wanted to get to it, and I had to go back and explain in long term, you know, cut several pages as to what the problem was. They said, well, what would you predict would be the loss of crop production due to soil acidity in Nepal? Very good question. I don't have an answer for that, you know, other than I can tell you that if you have a real acid problem, you're going to have decreased yields. And we do have data, for example, that like on maize, when it drops below like pH of 5, you can have as much as 50% reduction in yield. We have some of those kinds of data that we can back into. And so it builds a case for liming, balanced fertility, building your program up to a higher level. And we do know that as we do that, we get better crop response to what we do or what we're doing and what we're applying, and therefore the margins become better. And we know that, you know, that farmers can get the most out of it by balancing it that way. But there's not a, I wish I had hard, fast numbers for a lot of it, but it's a lot of it is based on experience. But I think it's really important that we get people to understand that it's part of a big picture of crop management, and it has to do with, you know, the soil management, has to do with the varieties, it has to do with irrigation. I spent a fair amount of time in my report on the importance of irrigation. Nepal needs to develop the irrigation system. I mean, they're right there at the foot of the Himalayas. I mean, come on, you know. India benefits from their water, you know. I mean, they need to intercept some of that and do a better job of irrigation and not just depend on the monsoon season to grow something. So there's a lot of things that play into a lot of these countries. Water is one of the biggest factors. We haven't even touched on that today, but that's a major thing.
We have a last question from online.
This question comes from Felix Nyamador. Would the panelists advise African countries to establish domestic fertilizer industries, meaning manufacturing and blending, as options to reduce cost?
Go ahead, David. Just a couple of remarks, and then I'm now curious to see what David has to say. But. Certainly, that's a case-by-case kind of an approach, and it depends on a lot of things. It depends on the resource base that's available to enter into fertilizer primary product manufacturing, whether you have the natural gas supplies, the power, potentially phosphate rock, potentially potash deposits. And those resources and deposits are in a lot of places, but they're not always commercially viable or exploitable. So it's a very complex issue, and it varies place by place. And it's influenced, again, by all the factors we've talked about today in terms of logistics and cross-border trade and the definition of what a fertilizer product is and those kinds of things. So it's a very, very complex kind of an issue. The second part, blending, which is sometimes referred to as manufacturing, but it's really the transformation of existing manufactured fertilizer products, in my mind, I think does have an important role to play. It has the potential to take advantage of the delivery of bulk fertilizer commodities and then to blend them into specific nutrients for particular crops that'll go in particular areas of a country and create a little bit more site-specific kind of an approach to the fertilization regime in a particular country. Relatively inexpensive when you're talking about building a blending plant, which is kind of a high-tech, sophisticated cement mixing kind of an operation, versus a very complex ammonia urea facility or a phosphate rock mining and chemical complex that can cost hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion or more, to undertake. So very different animals, and I think there is an important and immediate role for the kinds of things like blending facilities. And in terms of primary fertilizer manufacturing, I think it's more of a case-by-case situation and one that may develop over time. So.
When nobody else was about to answer, I was going to say I'll answer since I know less about that than anyone else on the panel. But I'd echo everything Peter says. Personally, I don't see that question as a food security or agriculture issue. I see it as kind of an economic and industrial strategy issue. And I think one of the great, you know, disappointments and concerns of African policymakers and economists and the rest of us who are involved in African development is that the manufacturing sector in most African countries hasn't developed as fast as anyone would have liked or expected. And so an important question for policymakers is, where does it make sense to try to draw in investment in manufacturing? And for all the reasons Peter just stated about the very high complexity and demands of a fertilizer manufacturing industry, not in terms of blending, but in terms of, you know, whatever the formulation you're just talking about was, that may not be, you know, the wisest choice for African countries that have seen kind of, you know, not as great progress as they wanted as manufacturing. Why would you start at kind of the top end of sophistication and demands when there are both more labor-intensive and less complex ways to kind of get involved and jumpstart a manufacturing sector? But I don't see that as a food security question. The same approaches and policies that Marie laid out from the briefer on how to make the fertilizer sector work better, whether you're an importer or a manufacturer, whether your supplies are coming domestically or internationally, apply in either case. Those get at the food security issues, regardless of where the manufacturing plant happens to be located that's generating the fertilizer you're using.
Okay, thank you, David. And I want to, on behalf of the entire EAT project, say a big thank you to everyone, to all of our panelists, and also to the entire AgriLinks team for helping us put on this event, and to all of you here and online for your wonderful questions. Our panelists will be hanging around for a little while afterwards, grabbing another cup of coffee if you have any additional questions. And after that, if you would like to ask anything else, feel free to email us at the EAT project at eat@fintrack.com. Or you can find me or our chief of party, Nate Klein, after the event. Thank you again for coming.
Thank you all. And also thank you from USAID BFS for attending. Please take a moment to fill out the evaluations that are sitting on your chair. And for those of you online, we'll have a link for you or have had a link. We take these seriously, and we appreciate your participation. Also remember, our next Ag Twitter chat is tomorrow. At 2, I believe, so please join us for that. And resources will be emailed out after this event to let you know where to find them on AgriLinks, so you'll get the audio recording and the like. Thank you again. Have a good day.